I count it an honor and a privilege and a pleasure to be invited to come back and enjoy with you and join with you in the missionary seminar that is occupying your time during this summer session. And I welcome the opportunity to visit again with the college church. Our time is limited, and I want to address myself immediately to the subject that was assigned me, and I want you to know to begin with that it was assigned me. It wasn't of my choosing. The subject is the ghosts of past failures. Now, what can you say that's encouraging about that? I guess you're starting at the bottom with this seminar, so any way you go has to be up. The ghosts of past failures. I've always been scared to death of ghosts. I don't take much stock in the past, and I don't like to discuss the word failure at all. So this subject's going to be a difficult one for me tonight from that standpoint. Ghosts of past failures. So far as research is able to determine, churches of Christ sent out their first missionary to a foreign field in 1886, just 85 years ago. He was a Frenchman named Delaunay, who with his wife went to France and died there 6 years later. No trace of his work has ever been found. Then in 1889, John Larut was sent to British Guinea. And he stayed 17 years and disappeared. What became of him, nobody knows. And no trace of his work remains. Azariah Paul was sent to Turkey in 1889, and he stayed 4 years. And all traces of the work he did in Turkey have long since vanished. Strother Cook was sent out in 1891 to Nigeria. And Brother E.S. Jelly was sent to southern India. Cook stayed 16 years and came home. Jelly went over to the denominations. And all traces of both of their works have completely disappeared. Between 1892 and 1897, Carmen Hollister, Lucius Scott, J.M. McCaleb, Ladisky Warlick, Eugene Snodgrass, R.L. Pruitt, Alice Miller, Nettie Kramer, and Otessa Figuemura were sent to Japan. And all traces of all the work that all of them did has completely disappeared, with the exception of that of J.M. McCaleb. John Sheriff went from New Zealand to southern Rhodesia in 1896. He lived there till he died and left a thriving work which continues to this day. John Karagusigan went to Cyprus. And John Boyes de Hemis to Crete in 1897. Karagusigan stayed 4 years. And there isn't any record of whatever became of him. And Boris Gehenis disappeared likewise, as did all traces of any of the work that he did. C.M. Wilmoth and his wife, Mrs. Rutherford, Rich Watson, and another whose name we do not know, went to Mexico in 1898. Three of the four, and possibly four of the five, died that same year. Also going and returning in the same 12-month period were Irene Watson, Matt and Leela Womack, and Mr. and Mrs. Henry, and Mr. and Mrs. Davidson, and Mr. and Mrs. Kendrick. All traces of any work they did has completely disappeared. These are all of the missionaries that were sent out by Churches of Christ prior to 1900. And the only surviving trace of any evidence of any work that any of them ever did is a little in Japan, left of the McCaleb work, and a fairly strong work in Rhodesia, which has survived sure. Ghosts of past failures. In 1906, there was a separate census designation made in the United States between the Christian churches and the Churches of Christ. The missionaries mentioned up to this point were sent out by Churches of Christ, for there were no Christian churches prior to the fight over the use of instrumental music and other things. But when the census designation was made in 1906, Churches of Christ were down to 12 missionaries. And in the next 33 years, up until 1939, that is the beginning of World War II, Churches of Christ sent out 143 missionaries, and this figure includes their wives. And of that 143, 113 of them returned home, or else died on the field, or defected to some denomination by the end of 1939. Eight of the number had left us to fellowship with the Seventh-day Adventists, the Christian Church, or the Pentecostal churches. Ghosts of past failures. This is mission work, all of it, among Churches of Christ, up to the beginning of World War II, relatively recent time, and these are tragic case histories. Not long ago, I visited in the bookstore of Virgil Smith in São Paulo, Brazil. Virgil Smith and Orla Boyer were both graduates of Abilene Christian College in 1927. They went to Brazil immediately to do mission work. They both went over to the Pentecostal Church, and Boyer wrote 40 books, which are used as standard texts on how to do it among all the Pentecostal churches of the world. Virgil Smith told me that he had personally, with his own hands, baptized over 100,000 people. He said to me, when they tell you that on the day of Pentecost they couldn't baptize 3,000 in one day, they are wrong, for I personally have baptized over 5,000 in one day. That, of course, was after their fellowship with the Christian churches. Ghosts of past failure. I asked Virgil Smith why. Why he had turned to fellowship with the Pentecostal churches. And tears came to his eyes, and he became emotionally almost out of control. And he said to me, Boyer and I came to South America fresh out of Abilene Christian College. We had two churches that said they would send us to South America, and we received each one check after we arrived on the field. And then we never did receive another check. We didn't even receive a letter saying this will be your last check. There just wasn't any other communication. And then he said, we almost starved to death. He said, we ate garbage out of the people's garbage cans behind their houses here in the city of São Paulo. He said, we were picked up by the Pentecostals in their service program to downtrodden people. He said, they literally saved us from starving to death, and they nursed us back to health. He said, is it any wonder to you that we are now with the Pentecostals? Of course, I realize there is always another side to most any coin. And I realize that a report like this is probably highly prejudicial. And yet the essential facts in it are probably true because they have been repeated over and over and over again in the history of our short 85 years on the mission fields. Ghosts of past failures, they ought to haunt us. It isn't enough to say that these missionaries that went to the Adventists, the Pentecostals, or the Mormons were weak and they should have known better. I am thoroughly persuaded that the fault was not all theirs. Not long ago, I was reading in the Christian Standard, which is the leading publication of the independent Christian churches, about the opening of the cornerstone of Campbell Hall. Get that word. Campbell Hall. On the university campus of one of the teacher colleges in the state of Oregon. I read about the reading of the documents that had been deposited there in 1871, soon after the Oregon Trail had opened and settlement had begun. Faded though they were still legible. And of course, the Christian church, as it always does, was claiming credit for the work done in Oregon in the 1870s. There was not an instrument in any of the Oregon churches in 1870. They didn't have a single missionary society out there. And they didn't believe in Oregon the things that produced a divided fellowship around the turn of the century. And so these were not Christian churches by anybody's standard. They were churches of Christ. They were churches that occupy the same ground that you occupy And it may surprise you to know that the first 27 churches established in the state of Oregon were all churches of Christ. And that at one time, they operated three Christian colleges in the state of Oregon, one of which was this college, which has now become one of the state teacher colleges in Oregon. And the historic old hall, still a part of the campus, was named Campbell Hall by the people who started the first 27 churches in the state. Now, the only trace that exists in Oregon is a musty cornerstone opened last year at the age of 100 years, plus one small Oregonian congregation of 17 members which has weathered the storm for 100 years and still occupies the position that they occupied then. Ghosts of past failures. A pagan jungle rapidly takes over a neglected work. I have often wondered how it must feel to one of the native converts left behind by a departing missionary as he goes back home, especially if no successor to him has been named. In every one of these works that I have mentioned, no doubt every missionary left behind him a small nucleus or nuclei of faithful disciples when he left. Doubtlessly, they struggle for a while. But a flickering flame in a sea of mighty darkness grows feeble when the pressures come, like the waves rolling in from the sea. Social pressures, economic pressures, political pressures, pressures of temptation, like crushing walls coming in on a claustrophobia-stricken little element that's left, these pressures are almost undeniable. For a while they pray. They clasp their hands and beg for strength just to be faithful until they die. And then after a while, the feeble spark sputters and dies out, and the darkness settles in again, and all signs that a missionary was ever there have disappeared from another pagan jungle. This has been the history of mission work, these many years. The other day, I was on the campus of Fuller Theological Seminary, and I was listening to a speech made by the president of Korean Christian College, a Presbyterian school in Seoul, Korea. In fact, I was doing two things. I was listening to the speech he was making, and I was reading the speech he made yesterday. I got that habit from the ACC lectureship. It's the only way you can get two in one. But I was reading a lecture that he delivered yesterday. He was telling in that lecture of a Chinese girl. After Mao had taken over mainland China and had persecuted and driven out the missionaries or imprisoned and killed them, and had subjected to slavery the small remnants of the peoples in China that had been converted to Christianity. The missionaries had all gone home. They had all been killed or were in prison, and here was this little girl, separated from her father and her mother, who still lived in the country, and she was in Peking. And she came desperately asking, "How long can I hold out?" Pleading, "Give me strength, O Lord, to hold out against my schoolmates that make fun of me. The ill treatment that they give me because I am a Christian, because of the incredibly cruel things that they say and do to me, because I am a Christian and not a communist. Lord, give me the power to hold out." And after she had gone a few weeks, the missionary that was still left, to whom she had cried, passed through the halls of one of the universities. And he saw scribbled on the bulletin board for all to read her note that she had been completely duped by the American missionaries, that she realized that communism was the only hope of the soul, that she repented of having caused so much trouble to her fellow students and to the administration of her university by her stubborn and willful and sinful holding out for this Jesus. And she repented of all of that, and she asked the forgiveness of the students and the faculty. And then there was her name signed at the bottom of it. And all signs that a missionary had been there disappeared. Ghosts of past failures. If I could list two or three causes why missions fail, it would run something like this. Number one, the zeal of those who want to go is not always matched by the zeal of those who are willing to send. And this has to be a team effort. Sometimes there is an ocean between the sending congregation and the one that has been sent. And regardless of how much zeal the one sent may have, if the group sending doesn't match that zeal, there is always a breakdown. Too many of our mission efforts result from somebody saying, "I want to go, and will you send me?" And the folks at home said yes. More because of the urging of the one who wanted to go than because of any sense of personal commitment or of personal responsibility on the part of those who are going to send. Too often the missionary is a one-man promoter of his cause to the country to which he is going. Second, a lack of cultural knowledge on the part of those who go causes a breakdown in many of our mission works. There is a great need for prospective missionaries to be trained in cross-cultural relationships. And right now I want to put in a plug, a commercial, for any of our colleges anywhere in the country who are carrying on a missionary seminar such as the one being carried on this campus this year in an effort to rivet the hearts and the minds of prospective missionaries upon the fact that they're going to be foreigners in a culture about as completely foreign to them
as a culture can be, and circumstances about which they know so little and are not able to really learn too much. I think it's much better to find out in such seminars as this one whether one is fitted for mission work in a difficult field, because it's much better to fail and to flunk out in a missionary seminar such as this one than it is to buy a boat ticket and raise $10,000 and travel all over the Brotherhood, wear out your car and go spend 3 months on a foreign station and then flunk out. A foreign culture loses its luster quickly. Underscore that. A foreign culture loses its luster quickly. And you don't know what homesickness is until you have experienced the homesickness of a missionary among a people whose language he can't understand, who can't even ask the time of day or buy a potato or find the way to the center of the city. It's worse than seasickness. And seasickness, you get to where you're afraid you won't die. And missionary homesickness is two steps below that. In the third place, and I think this may be the weakest spot in all our mission work, that is the lack of knowledge and know-how on the part of the sponsoring congregation. An eldership in a Central Texas church can hardly sit here in Central Texas and never visit a mission field and be a dime's worth of good when it comes to furnishing advice to somebody on a foreign field fraught with all of the foreign problems that they have. I go to bat every once in a while for a missionary who has gotten crosswise with his sponsoring congregation. Partly because I've been crosswise with some missionaries and I didn't know what I was talking about. I thought I could tell them how to do their job in their field, and I had never been there. And elderships cannot tell a missionary how to meet his local problems in his field unless they go see the field. We'd have a lot less friction between missionaries and sponsoring congregations if the elders of Texas churches would go walk in the moccasins of the missionary for 2 weeks. The missionary is on the field. We are not. When we think we can tell them how to tend to their business, we usually wind up in common failure. This is why missionaries plead with elderships to visit this field and to try to furnish them advice. At least you can be knowledgeable when you do it that way. And here is another commercial. They come every 2 minutes. I tried to establish the Pan American Lectureship about 10 years ago. Because I have traveled over most of Central and South America, and I know the abysmal communication gap between stateside elderships and Latin American missionaries. And in an effort to get statewide elderships down into the Latin field, where they could get the feel of the local culture, and be able to see at least some of the local problems and be understanding and sympathetic with the problems of the missionaries, In an effort to do that, we founded the Pan American Lectureship. And I find this to be true. If a missionary is having a problem with his eldership, his sponsoring congregation, if I can get the elders of that congregation to go down and meet him at the Pan American Lectureship, that usually solves their communication gap. I also notice this. If I can get elderships to go into a Latin American field, you come back home simply appalled at the missionary opportunity and the myriad millions who don't know their right hand from their left. Every member of the Church of Christ ought to have to go into some foreign section of the world at least once. I think the Lord could have done a lot to see that the Great Commission were carried out if he had demanded faith, repentance, and baptism and a trip to a mission field. One will save you, and the other would save the world. If we could somehow get complacent, unconcerned members of the church involved in some missionary situation, we wouldn't have any trouble finding support for missionaries. Ghosts of our failures are far more numerous since 1931 than they were before that time. And the reason for it is we're sending out many, many more missionaries. So the law of averages would give us more failures. But if we send 10 times as many missionaries, there isn't any sense in our making 10 times as many mistakes. Because we don't have to perpetuate mistakes. We blundered along and stumbled along in our mission work up until now. We were determined not to follow in the rut of denominational missionary courses. And I think it was a good thing, because denominational mission groups have perpetuated their own mistakes for 400 years. After all, they didn't have any outside source to which they could go for resource material. They had to blunder along. They've just blundered for 400 years instead of 85. That's the only difference. And along in the course of time, others have started in the old rut and have continued in it. But we were determined not to do it that way, and we have had some rather sensational breakthroughs in mission work. A man of international reputation in mission fields, in mission writing and teaching missionaries how to missionary, told me not long ago, he said, churches of Christ have come further in 30 years than most religious groups have come in 300 years. And he said, instead of reading the books that we have written on how to do it, said, we wish you would write some books on how you did it so we could teach this to our students. So we ought not to feel that all of our past is taken up with mistakes. We have made some, and we will continue to make some. You can't do anything without making a few mistakes along the way. And we'll never get this thing down perfect. But we can reduce our mistakes, and we can dispel some of the ghosts. We can't undo history. And all of these who have gone to foreign fields, either died or defected or come back home, And the jungle of heathenism has come in and swept away the work forever. These ought to spur us on to better methods and better ways of doing our work. We ought to develop some way to keep the heathen jungle from coming back in if our American missionaries have to come home. And it can be done. In Nigeria, before the war, we had a great work going. A large number of congregations, thousands of converts, hundreds of native preachers. And then came the Afrin War. And everybody thought that it would erase forever the effects of our mission work in Nigeria. But to our amazement, when we were able to get back into the country, we found we had more preachers after the war than before, more members of the church after the war than before, despite the ravages of the war. And I think hidden in our modus operandi in Nigeria is one of the secrets of keeping the jungle from coming back in and wiping out the missionaries' efforts. And one of your own professors is largely responsible for that secret. And those of you who are studying here in this missionary seminar, I think you're going to get some of the secrets of how to keep the waves from washing out the marks you make in the sands of time on whatever shores you may work. These ghosts of past failures, while they ought to haunt us, ought not to discourage us to the point of causing us to turn back. Our time is gone. We're singing the verses of an invitation song tonight for the benefit of any man or any woman, any responsible person whose life is not right with God. For whatever cause it may be, will you respond by coming down to the front while we sing this song together?